We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Impressionist and comedian John Coleshaw made his debut on the cult satirical sketch show Spitting Image in 1994 and later appeared on BBC Radio 2's It's Been a Bad Week. During the late 90s, he featured as a regular contributor to The Chris Moyle Show on Drive Time Radio 1 before securing the award-winning Dead Ringers in the year 2000, alongside Jan Ravens. Just 3 years later, John saw the show's successful transition from Radio 4 to BBC 2 as the popularity of the series expanded. A surprise union between actress Deborah Stevenson in 2009 would return impressionism to primetime BBC One and cement John's status as one of Britain's biggest voices. I caught up with the Evergreen comic on the most southerly leg of his nationwide tour to talk heroes, politics, and reflections on an unparalleled career in British comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Coleshaw.
In terms of icons of impressionism, Britain has had a very rich history. I'm thinking of John Bird doing Harold Wilson on TW3, and of course the great Mike Yarwood. How important were these moments in shaping TV impressionism in Britain?
Oh, they were hugely important. John Bird at the time of TW3, you know, satire was really starting to take on its modern form then. That really did change all of the rules. And Mike Yarwood, he's a pal of mine, actually. I know Mike quite well. We have a curry every 2 or 3 months. And he loves to talk about the old days. And the brilliant thing about Mike Yarwood is that he was really the first big-time TV impressionist. And he was the first to have access to all of the multi-cameras, all of the split screens. And instinctively, he knew exactly how to use that to create the feeling of this plethora of characters. And everybody since has followed the way that Mike did it. So it was really Mike Yarwood who kicked the door open for everybody, really. And we still follow that code that he set. And also, I think another wonderful thing about Mike Yarwood was, even before he'd spoken a word, the way he inhabited the characters facially. I've seen him do it across the curry table when he turns into Ken Dodd or Hancock. Something happens, as they say, behind the eye, and Mike vanishes and the character comes forward. It's breathtaking to witness that. It really is. So they're hugely important. Mm.
And like so many of your generation, you began your career in radio. However, you were actually a DJ on commercial radio. Now, what sort of grounding in entertainment did this give you?
Yes, it was interesting starting in radio. I used to volunteer at the local hospital radio, Radio Ormskirk General. And this was in the late 80s, late 86, 1987. I was 18, 19 at the time. And at that stage, you're not quite sure altogether what you want to do, but you know what you don't want to do. I'd be rubbish working in an office or a bank. I'd be like Frank Spencer or Stan Laurel. I wouldn't be very good at that. I thought radio would just be an interesting place to start, to see where it goes to. And I talk about this in the show, actually. I had a job in the summer of 1984 washing cars in Ormskirk, in a place called Park Motors. And when you're washing cars all day, you can have the radio on. And it got me listening to radio programs and thinking, how do they do this? How do they knit the programs together? Yeah. How do they choose the music in these sequences? And it all dovetails perfectly up to the news. And I was fascinated. And it just gave me a feeling of, that's what I'll do. And I volunteered at the local hospital radio to start with. Radio Ormska General. I think I did some of the announcements a bit like that.
Well, how much freedom were you allowed in creating your own content? And was it around this time that you met Chris Moyles?
Oh, that happened. Meeting Chris Moyles came a few years later. Radio was quite polite in those days. Certainly hospital radio had to be quite polite in the 80s. I think it was Alan Bezick on Red Rose Radio who was famously acerbic at a time when not many presenters were really doing that. He'd be really gruff, really rough, but wow, he was so listenable and he had such a following. That was very groundbreaking. You know, it was very unusual to hear such acerbic presenters. So there was a fair amount of freedom. I think when I was 19 and 20, you're quite experimental. You're trying out what your different ideas are. You're trying to figure out what your personality is and the type of shows you do. Some of it works, some of it doesn't. But you've just got to keep trying and just keep evolving until you get to what it is you do. I'd worked on the radio for quite a few years before I met Chris Moyles. I'd worked at various stations, Viking Radio in Hull, Radio Hallam in Sheffield, Pennine Radio in Bradford, which became the Pulse of West Yorkshire, Radio Wave in Blackpool. It was when I moved to London to do Spitting Image, I started doing some London radio, Capital Radio, working with Steve Penk on the mid-morning show. And Chris Moyles was working there at the time. He was doing the very early breakfast show, 4 till 6 in the morning, a horrible, knackering show to do, so he says. I met Chris then, and we lived in the same neighbourhood. We were united by a common pub. that's how I got to know Chris. And I always do like collaborating with other presenters. I always like to be part of a team, which is always a nice way to do things.
Well, that goes nicely into this next question, which is your association with Chris Moyles followed him all the way to Radio 1, where you helped them to push the boundaries of afternoon broadcasting. Now, can you tell us about the time you made a phone call to Downing Street, pretending to be someone very important?
Oh, yes, indeed. That was with Steve Penk, actually.
Ah.
It was the time when William Hague was the leader of the opposition. This delightful voice, which is so irresistible to impersonate. And I had a chat with Steve Penk saying, we have to do this character. Where can we call? And Steve Penk would always see the most direct route through to, you know, the objective. And he says, well, we've got to call Downing Street, haven't we? We might as well phone Downing Street. So, okay. So we wrote down some little conversational possibilities, never expecting to get through. We thought it might be, yes, hello, it's William Hague. Could I speak to the Prime Minister, please? Oh, go away, stop wasting our time. Well, how dare you? I am the leader of the opposition. Am I not important enough to be put through? What an outrage. And we thought there'd be a bit of comedy value in that.
Yeah.
But the opposite happened. It happened to be a Wednesday when we phoned up. And on a Wednesday, it was quite normal for the leader of the opposition to call for the Prime Minister. So the very helpful person on reception put us through.
It all happened to work out. That's fantastic.
And, you know, we had a nice little chat with Mr. Blair, you know, who was, you know, he always liked his, you know, sense of humour. So, yes, to be announced later that day by Sir Trevor MacDonald. I don't think life ever got more surreal than that moment.
Josh has just asked, how long was it before they realised?
It was pretty quick, actually. It was pretty quick, because although publicly Blair always said, you know, let's keep it informal, just call me Tony. William Hague had a very sarcastic, sardonic Yorkshire sense of humour and wouldn't play along with that. He would always call him Prime Minister, as if to go, nah.
Yeah.
So when I said, hello, Tony, he knew something was up, but played along good-naturedly nonetheless.
Fantastic. Now, in 2000, following in the footsteps of Titans of Comedy, you secured your own Radio 4 sketch show, Dead Ringers, alongside Jan Ravens, Alistair McGowan and Kate Robbins. Why do you think it was such a hit?
Oh, my goodness. 20 years ago, Dead Ringers.
20 years
ago. I think a lot of the reason why it's such a hit is down to its creator and producer, Bill Dare, who has got such an instinct and such a feel for comedy and how to make it work, just how to really tee it off. I think Radio 4 have been very supportive to it as well. Radio 4, given its image, you know, to have a slightly, you know, misbehaving, rather cheeky comedy show on Radio 4. But there was a lot of appeal in that. And I just think it's the quality of the writing. It's the quality of the writing. And not just that, but I think Dead Ringers has always had kind of an attitude of its own. It's got its own little take on things. It's got its own attitude to things. It's not just the gags. It sort of has its own personality, which feeds into it rather nicely. As we turn into David Dimbleby to commentate, here's some people who have been to the gymnasium walk past. There we are.
Yeah, we're on the middle of a runway here for people going in and out of the gym.
Exactly. Life is going on all around
us. It's abundant.
It is all around us.
How difficult is it to convey recognised faces without any pictures?
I think it's a good recognisable character is recognisable in whichever way. In whichever way. On the radio, we might use a catchphrase, we might use some sort of announcement. It was interesting when Dead Ringers was on TV for 5 years and seven series, that opened up a whole sense of doing the visual gags as well. You could do mannerisms, you could do, you know, like Ozzy Osbourne brushing his hair away, or
you know, Tony Blair having very jerky gesticulations of his hands, you know, the splayed fingers, and
George Bush with that look upon his face. With the Donald, you know, we would do that very interestingly, you know, with the little pinchy hand gestures and that kind of, the pouting face to look, those lips of Donald Trump that look like some tropical fish that's awaiting being fed. I think on the radio, the voices are so recognisable. And just in the writing, the tone of the writing just sets it up so that it's so that it works on radio. There's a difference for writing for the eye and writing for the ear.
Yeah.
And the writers are very familiar with that. You just get that subtle difference.
And for the listeners that couldn't see that then, John literally did just transform into all of those people that...
I am very, very sorry. I am very sorry. I will not do it again.
No.
I promise I will not do it again.
Well, like so many programmes of this time, you saw the successful transition of Dead Ringers from radio to television in 2003. Now, how difficult was this process to perfect?
It was a wonderful challenge. It really was a wonderful challenge. You wonder to what extent you're going to use makeup, wigs and do all of that. And in the end, you just have to do it. You have to go down that visual road. And as I say, it brought out a whole new way of presenting the characters. And it just broadened the whole dimension of it. We built Downing Street. We would build a corner of the House of Commons. And it also led us down the road of doing many different characters that we didn't do on the Radio 4 version. Dead Ringers on Radio 4 is a very Radio 4-ish show, with the archers and the shipping forecasts and the various announcers. BBC Radio 4, be it Neil Newnes or Brian Perkins, as was at the time. Now, when the show went to TV, we could bring in other characters that we'd never do on the radio version. Robbie Williams, Russell Crowe, the Arctic Monkeys, whoever it might have been, Liam Gallagher, Lord of the Rings. It allowed us to take that cheeky sense of humour and apply it to other things. And yes, it was a lovely time, time to do.
I think a personal favourite of mine would always be Brian Cox.
Yeah, Brian Cox, Professor Brian Cox, I think he's one of those characters.
I'm an amateur astronomer anyway, so I always find that fascinating. So I love the way Brian Cox conveys the hugeness and fascination of the universe.
And Sir Patrick Moore as well. Astronomers are always very, very interesting indeed. I think it's because Patrick Moore spoke very, very quickly that a Scout Night episode lasted 20 minutes.
Whereas because Brian Cox spoke like this, an episode of Wonders of the Solar System goes on for an hour.
Carl Sagan, somewhere in the middle, speaking at that rate would be probably a 45-minute show. But I love the science communicators.
It's all so different as well.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, you secured another television primetime series in 2009 when you teamed up with Deborah Stevenson for The Impressions Show. Now, to what extent do you think celebrity culture had changed since Dead Ringers?
Yes, it was really starting to become this... this something that everybody latched on to. I think the sort of Facebook, Instagram world we know now was starting to form then. Alistair McGowan and Ronnie Ancona did that so beautifully with their show, The Big Impression. Yeah. That was like Hello Magazine set to television. And the Impression show had its own sort of attitude as well. We had the staples of the One Show, The Apprentice, Dragon's Den.
Yeah.
And I love the working rapport that Deborah and I have, which we still have today. It's wonderful when she does some Dead Ringers episodes. We'll be doing that in Edinburgh this year. It really wasn't. She's such a lovely person, Deborah. She's so lovely to work with. They were very,
very happy days. I'm turning to Terry Wogan to convey the warmth of the memories. There we were in the summertime of 2009, 10 and 11. There I remember when we did a sketch of John Craven getting married to Lady Gaga. There was Lady Gaga on Countryfile, sort of dressed in a hybrid of an outlandish frock and a privet hedge.
Yeah.
Yes, it was surreal memories, but that's how they should be.
Well, you've just embarked on a nationwide tour, The Great British Takeoff. What can you tell us about it?
It's quite spontaneous, quite unscripted. We just let the show flow. There's Bill, he's just gone by there.
Hi Bill, how you doing?
This is Bill, the creator and producer of Dead Ringers, just coming into the interview just now.
No, this is Josh. I'm Will, I'm just the voice, Josh is the brain. somewhat. You don't know. No, okay, fair enough.
So we're doing our pre-show interview. Okay, I was just singing your praises, Bill.
Oh, thank you. How's it going?
Going pretty well. We've just got another two questions, and then we'll let you guys.
Where's the stage door?
I think the stage door is out there, down the bottom. But if you turn right through there, you'll be right in the theatre, and you can go down and. Thank you, Mark. Cheers.
You've got the knowledge. You see, you've got the knowledge.
Oh, Josh, you want another question? Yeah. What question are you for? So you were at Bob Monkhouse's last gig.
Yes. Yes.
So Josh has asked, what was Bob Monkhouse's last gig like?
It was incredible. It was at a pub in Great Portland Street in London. The basement of a pub called the Lowdown. This was 2003, and I consider myself very lucky to have been invited there. And I was sat with Reese Shearsmith and David Williams. And I think Bob had been unwell, but his condition was contained, and he was coping well with it. And I think at the time Bob just wanted to connect with the way he used to do stand-up, the way he started out. Just to simply walk out there in an intimate venue and tell a few gags, tell a few stories. And it was amazing to witness Bob's skill as a comedian. Just his skill, how relaxed he was, how he just delivered all the gags so effortlessly, every one of them landed. And just his skill. I think Bob Monkhouse and Ken Dodd, actually, I heard them describe a joke. It's like the perfect miniature three-act play with the setup, the sort of slight misdirection in the middle and the unexpected punchline in the end. It's a precise piece of engineering. And Bob Monkhouse approached his comedy with that very sort of detailed way. And
the very thoughtful manner in which he delivered them. And it was just wonderful to be in his presence. And when he brought out Mike Yarwood to have a chat with Mike, none of us were expecting that. Yes. And that was magic to see. It really was magic to see. So it was a very special night, and I'm just grateful that BBC Four, it's one of those things that they show quite a lot.
Yeah.
They show it nice and often, so it's lovely to relive it.
Hmm. Well, looking back at your career, what is your proudest achievement?
Oh, goodness me. I was, I think the 20 years of Dead Ringers, that's been amazing to be part of. I was very proud to be on the Parkinson show. That was really something. I was so nervous just before going on to Parkinson, because you think of all the people who have been on there, you know, Jimmy Stewart, Muhammad Ali, all of the, you know, Lauren Bacall, all of these names. And you think, goodness me, what am I doing there? And you get very nervous. But such is Michael Parkinson's great skill and great relaxed sort of manner that he'll just sort of simply ask the first question and straight away, you're relaxed and everything's fine and you just get into a flowing conversation. So I was very proud to be on Parkinson, the Raw Variety performance, very proud of that as well. So, those are a few things that that come to mind. The 50th anniversary of The Sky at Night with Sir Patrick Moore. That was another very, 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 very fascinating programme to be a part of. There's
lots of proud moments.
Nice, a bit of variety to look back on, you know.
Josh just asked. Joss has just asked, didn't you interview Parkinson as Parkinson on Christmas Night with the Stars?
Yes, I did. We had this idea of Michael Parkinson would be in his present day sort of style, you know, the silver hair and the blue suit. And I would be the 1970s Parkinson in the brown suit with the the sideburns, and I would interview him as him, and he was. I've done a few interviews like that. I did a show called Alter Ego, where I interviewed various people as them, where the reaction would flicker somewhere between laughter and terror. But Parkinson really got it. And he knew that the value in it was that it was confusing, and it should be slightly, you know, just confusing and slightly wrong-footing people. So he got that absolutely perfectly, and it was a lovely memory. That it was a lovely memory as well, because it was recorded very close to Christmas, and it was the last sort of professional thing I was going to do that particular year, and I knew that I was, in a couple of days after that, was going to be travelling home for Christmas, and I'd see my parents, and just the sense of getting back home.
It was a nice way to cap off the working year.
Yeah, exactly, to cap off the working year. That's exactly what it was.
Perfect.
And it was lovely.
Well, finally, what is next for John Coleshaw?
I am going to be, we're doing Dead Ringers Live. We're touring Dead Ringers Live.
Fantastic.
We're doing that around the country, also in Edinburgh. And I'm going to be doing a few shows of the Great British Take Off in Edinburgh as well. I'm doing some more Doctor Who Big Finish productions. I play the Brigadier. Yes, Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart. I was very proud to play the Brigadier, the Doctor's great, great friend and ally. So I'm doing some of those. And then in the autumn, there's going to be a stage adaptation of Bill Bryson's, the great writer Bill Bryson. His book Notes from a Small Island is being turned into a theatre show, and I'm going to play Bill Bryson in that, which is a lovely thing to do. He's got a fabulous wit and a beautiful turn of phrase. So that's the rest of the year sorted out.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. I'm sorry that we kept you a little longer than we said we would.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.